This week's lecture partners last week's lecture, of course. Last week I talked about how Chesapeake Society evolved from this very tenuous existence on the shores of the James River to being a properly grounded, well-established society by 1660. And I talked about some of the issues about stability or instability and how Virginia became more stable over time. Well, this week, by contrast, we talk about New England society over the same period and how it faced a very different series of challenges. But certainly, you know, there were challenges to be faced. I made this point quite a few weeks ago now about the different nature of New England settlements, in the way it's not as geographically diverse. It's not just plantations, individual homes, carved estates out to the wilderness. It's small nuclear settlements concentrated on rivers and coasts. And this lecture is a bit about how those settlements interact with each other. But firstly, I'm going to talk a bit more about what one historian has called the New England mind, the mentality, the thought processes of New Englanders. Perry Miller, a famous historian back in the 1950s, wrote lots of books about Puritanism especially, wrote this book called The New England Mind, which is in the library if you want to read it. And he talks about Puritans being a very mentally tough, very disciplined people. And they're not easily cowed, they're not easily rebuffed or denied possibilities. They are resolute, they will keep on going, they are determined, and this is very important for our understanding of New England society, that they share this commonality. Puritans, because of their belief in God, because of their belief in the power of God, generally believe that that God controls their lives in very broad terms. He controls everything about their world, and that when things happen, in their personal lives or in their the broader polity or civic government, they happen because God wishes it. Therefore, if, for instance, their child dies in infancy, then it's because God wished it, and God, wanted to bring the child to Him early, and it's almost seen as like God took special favour on this child. He wanted to see this child, brought to God, when it was still very young. Or if there is an outbreak of plague where hundreds of different people are dying of this disease, or those who survive only survive through providentialism, they survive through God's desire to keep those people alive. And pretty much every aspect of their lives is symbolic. Every time that something happens, their chickens have a particular good, clutch of eggs that week, then that's because God recognised that they needed more eggs that week. Or if the Indians were defeated in a battle and the Indians were all killed, then God was clearly on their side and God helped them through this period of uncertainty. And so believing that God's on your side helps you to be mentally tough. Sometimes there are issues, sometimes there are problems and things don't go as you wish, but that's just God reminding you that you don't have control over everything. And God sometimes sends you tests to make sure that you are really tough enough to merit His love. Puritans, though, while they are incredibly religiously enthusiastic, and if any of you are evangelical or have ever seen evangelicals on television or at an evangelical Christian service, that sort of religious zeal comes out and sometimes can get a bit carried away, and Puritans are always on the cusp of being a bit carried away with their religion. But they also want to be able to control their behaviour. So, and this is a bit of a tension in the heart of Puritanism, in that you've got enthusiasm about religion, but the need, the desire, the wish for this control of your self-control, of your behaviour. Because you know, being godly does not, in Puritan ideology, demand you being, you know, loud or over-exuberant or, you know, full of the joys of Christianity. That's not how Puritans experience their religion. And it's deemed very sort of unseemly to be behaving like that. Miller, in this book, talks about five different ways, or five words, five key words that are worth remembering to explain how Puritans developed this concept of the world. The first of all is depravity. Puritans accept that all men are sinful, that all men are invariably sort of corrupt, purely by the fact of Adam's original sin, Adam's fall from Eden, the fall from grace, that all men are lapsed, and by that, by men I mean mankind, that no man is perfect, no man is without sin. So, you are all sinners, and you know you are sinners. And God knows that you are sinners. He knows the secrets of your hearts. However, the second word is covenant. And covenant is that God is somebody who will, who you, not so much that you can bargain with, but that God has a sense of fairness and he has an agreement. And the covenant, especially between God and Abraham, you know, you give yourself to God and God will look after you. And between God and man, in that, you know, if you give your soul, you give your person entirely into God's will and you trust in God's love for you, then he will, you know, be the person who comes through. And it's that, almost like a reciprocal obligation. God demands your complete submission, but in return he gives you, you know, eternal salvation, something. However, the third word is election. And election is all about who effectively is entitled or will gain grace, God's grace. And Puritans believe that not everybody is going to go to heaven. Not everybody is going to go, you know, those of you amongst you who are sinful, well, some of you will be saved, but some of you won't be saved. And election means that only a few people are going to become what Puritans talk about as being visible saints. These are people who are effectively told by God through the modicum of a conversion experience that they are saved before death. They know, the visible saints know for certain that they are going to heaven. There's no doubt, there's no question. When they die, is God going to judge them? God has prejudged them. It's like having a, you know, a pre-flight boarding pass. They are going to go to heaven. And the conversion experience is God's way of telling you that you're going to go to heaven. And by becoming a visible saint, by having a conversion experience that is testified to by people in public and is accepted by other people who are saints as being a valid conversion experience, so it's this sort of public portrayal of faith, saying this is how God came to me, this is how I experienced God's conversion experience, and other people saying that is a very valid experience and we accept you as a visible saint, then you gain a status in society. You become, for example, a full church member. Which I'll explain in a few minutes, you know, why that's important. So this idea that salvation isn't for everyone. It's something that, you know, is up to God, and it's and there's going to be people who are outside of that society. So effectively, there is a two-class society. The fourth word is grace. Now, grace is effectively God's forgiveness. It's something that God can give you freely of his own free will. But only he can give it. You can't earn grace. You can't earn forgiveness for your sins. You can't earn salvation. God is the only person who can give you salvation. And this is the very heart of Protestantism. That man is justified by faith. By faith alone. Man isn't justified by good works. Man isn't justified by being, paying for priests and chants, you know, this, that and the other, or buying indulgences for sin, or going to confession. That is not what you are justified by. You are justified only in the eyes of God by God alone, who will choose whether he bothers to give you his grace or not. So, grace and election are two sort of closely entwined things. And the fifth word is love. Basically, mankind has a duty to love each other. But love is not just romantic love or love for parents and siblings and children. It is also concern for someone else's soul, concern for someone else's behaviour. It's what you might call tough love. So you will punish and control and correct people when they do wrong things or misbehave. But you do it out of love. It's the classic phrase, this is going to hurt you more than it hurts me. As you wield a big stick. And that's exactly what Puritanism believes, is that, that it's only because you love somebody, because you care about their immortal soul, that you will bother to have restrictive rules about their behaviour. It's only because I love you all that I demand that you write me essays and that you turn up to seminars. That's purely the reason. It's exactly that kind of mentality. Because I'm concerned about you failing the degree, for instance. New England, as I said at the start, is settled on a very different basis to the Chesapeake. It's settled on this sort of township basis. And the towns are initially granted by a land grant to a group of families who will petition the General Court in Boston and say, we want to form our own community. And the General Court will say, okay, you can form your own community here, in this spot, and they will arrive at this place, and the townships are large, I'll show you a map of some of them in a minute. And what they then do is they divide the land up amongst themselves. So it's a really good idea to be in at the start. If you can be one of the founding families of a township, then you obviously can get the pick of the best lands. The lands that have, for example, fresh water, river access, that have well-drained fields, that aren't swampy or unproductive or stony, lands that are going to make you money, effectively. Not all the land is granted out at the start. So say if you've got a big township and the first 20 families are there and they grant out the land amongst themselves, they're not going to grant the entire township to these 20 families. They grant out a certain proportion of it. So you can move into these towns. The only problem is that if you are later arrival, then you are left with what's left, which may or may not be worthwhile having. So you might come and say, I want to come and join your township, but they may say, well, you can have this land, which is over here, up a hill and around the dale, and it's full of trees. And you might think, well, that's a fat lot, but I'm not going to go into corn on that. So actually it's increasingly common for new arrivals, especially when there's a group of them, to petition the General Court for their own township, to create their own township. So what you get are these spread of settlements, but they're nucleated in the sense that the settlement itself is quite small, but they're spread out geographically. And so New England towns, in general, are these sort of closed communities. There are opportunities for expansionism, but they're generally these closed communities, whereby once they're established, they sort of stay the same. But what they're sort of doing, but on a much smaller scale, is recreating English village-type settlements, where they relate to each other, of course. They trade with each other. The roads will pass through from one town to the next town. But they also have a relationship with Boston. For instance, each township can send two members to the General Court in Boston. And it's the General Court that is effectively a kind of parliament in New England. So the township has an important political role to play here, but it has an economic role, of course, as well. The distance from Boston depends on how easily you can get goods to market or get imported goods out to your township. So these all have an influence to how significant a town is and how important a town is and how these towns are run. And this map shows you, first of all, the spread of the counties. Those in dark brown are the oldest counties, and then followed by the ones in yellow. And you can see how they spread out from the coast, though with a significant concentration here in the that's the Connecticut River Valley, where Springfield and Northampton are in the middle of Massachusetts, and then they sort of fill in the bit in between in the 18th century. But you can see here just how big some of these townships are. You know, Concord, Massachusetts, which is sort of just in from Boston and up a bit, you know, it's a big place. It must be, you know, 100 square miles. So it's not, you know, a town in the sense that, oh, it's only 5 square miles. These are big geographic areas. But the town in the middle of Concord will be actually very small. And this is a just an idea about how things will be discussed in townships, and how you would have a sort of democratic structure there, though, as I'll come on to in a minute, you know, that democracy is not as democratic as you might think. But unlike in the Chesapeake, remember, where the Chesapeake, you've got a county government instituted, but it's not nucleated around a small village or anything like that. It's very much, you know, spread out, individual plantations. And as many of you talked about in your essays, which I've marked that half, I think, you all know the importance of religious enthusiasm to the settlement of New England. But it's very easy to believe, and it's erroneous to believe, that New England is a theocracy, because it's not. It's not a government of ministers, it's not a government of priests. What it is, though, is a government of the righteous. Meaning, those visible saints I talked about a minute ago, those who've demonstrated their conversion experience, who have become full members of churches, are the only people who can vote. And therefore, they're also the only people who can hold any position of authority, either as an elected representative or as some kind of colonial official. And so if you're not a saint, you're sort of marginalised from this process. So being a visible saint, being a full church member, is crucial to your experience of life in early Massachusetts. Religion is obviously very important to these people's lives. Many of you wrote about the matrix of motivation, David Grayson Allen's famous phrase, and how important religion was to that motivation. And that's all true. Religion is very important for people who went, and it remains important after they arrive in New England. The towns, these townships that they create, pretty much the first building that's erected is a church. Often before there are any houses built, the first thing they build is a church. And in 1635, there's a law in Massachusetts that says that no one can live more than half a mile from a church. Which again is going to encourage and foster nucleated settlements that are close to a church. You can't then say, well, I'm going to go live on the frontier, you know, in my little log cabin, you know, 25 miles away from any other people, because that's breaking that 1635 law. The land distribution, remember, townships are granted to land to these groups of individuals, but the way that the land is distributed is controlled by church members, because only they have the vote. So, if you're a non-church member, you may get land granted to you, but it won't be good land. And you won't have any influence over future people, whether they get better land than you or not. Throughout most of New England, Sunday is declared a day of rest, and it's actually illegal to do any work, any kind of work on a Sunday. So, you know, in some places it's illegal to cook on a Sunday. You have to prepare anything you want the day before. You certainly can't, you know, play games or go visiting or do any kind of frivolous activity. In fact, the only activity that is permitted is going to church. And in fact, it's not only permitted, it's compulsory. And this is not going to church like going to church today. This is where going to church would be a 4 or 5 hour long experience, the central part of this church service would not be communion like it often is in Anglican services today. It would be the sermon. The sermon would last 3 hours. So it's a bit of an endurance test. And you might think, well, you know, I just sit there and have a nap. You know, they wouldn't notice. Well, they would. And in fact, there are people employed in churches with big long sticks to spot people who are sleeping and poke them with a big stick to wake them up. I also have those in lectures, I think. Sometimes I'll have a big stick, and when I see a student just being off to go. So, they take the church attendance really seriously. You have to attend church, you have to sit through these long sermons, because that's so important to their way of life. And here's one of the oldest still remaining churches in Massachusetts, the Old Ship Meeting House in Hingham, Massachusetts, built in 1681. It's quite a grand building. And you can imagine how it would dominate the town, because you know, people have spent all their time and resources building a church like this, and their own homes would have come very much second, you know, and their own homes would be a fraction of the grandeur and the size and etc. Of the church. But again, that symbolises the dominance and the importance of the church in the community. It's the biggest, most impressive building. Not that dissimilar, though in a different context, to say, you know, the lord of the manor, the manor house being surrounded by all the hovels of the peasants. It's the same sort of idea. The biggest, most impressive building shows you the community ethos, the community ethic. But there are some quite impressive houses built in Massachusetts. Here's one built in Dedham, in Massachusetts, the Fairbank House, built in 1636. These very, very steep, sheer rooms, which almost look very Swiss Chalet-like, I think. But they do have cold winters in Massachusetts, so they want ones where the snow is going to fall off rather than sit on the roof and therefore collapse it, because the weight of the snow is very heavy. So that clapboard construction is very typically New England. And there's another one. And that's the Parsons House, Topsfield, Massachusetts, built in 1683. And that's a pretty impressive house for a parson. And that, again, is a symbol of how important the minister would be in that community. You know, the church is a magnificent building. The parson's house also should be a magnificent building because he's one of the most important members of that community. You can't let the parson live in a hovel. All those people have gone to New England to create their religious society. But how do you actually do that? You might have the aim of living this religious utopia, but in the real world, what sort of measures do you have to put in place to actually achieve it? Well, remember that the Puritans believed that everybody is sinful. Nobody can help but be sinful. And therefore, the rule of civil government is to help people not to be sinful. And so you institute a regime whereby you try and prevent sin effectively. So when you control people's behaviour, if you're a Puritan, you pass a law saying such and such things illegal, what effectively you're doing is trying to control sinfulness, not just criminality. And so it's not just what you would think of as crime as being, you know, having laws against it, like theft and murder and all those sort of things, which of course are illegal in Massachusetts, they're not like they're permitted. But the laws focus on moral crimes. They particularly focus on people's behaviour. And the laws are very personally invasive. They interfere with people's private lives, their private views, their private relationships with their children, etc. Men are given an acceptance of their natural authority over women and children and servants and slaves. It's that they have this sort of patriarchal authority, which is reinforced by Massachusetts law. And there's a great significant focus on these moral crimes. And by moral crimes, I mean things like gambling and drunkenness, lying, telling untruths about people, adultery, a very, very serious crime. Remember, adultery is one of the seven deadly sins, is it not? is it not? I'm sure there's some law against lying with another man's wife. I'm sure it's in there in the Bible somewhere. It's probably in the Levitic realm. That's what I meant. So you know them well, don't you? It's broken most. And Sabbath breaking, of course, not going to church on Sunday, that's also made a criminal offence in most of these places. And some of these offences are punished by beatings, others are punished by execution. So, you know, you can be executed for adultery. And there aren't many societies in human history where you can be executed for adultery. I mean, some Islamic societies, perhaps. And some New England colonies take not only the Ten Commandments, but the whole list, the whole legal codes in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, which are all about ancient Judaistic legal codes, and they sort of enact them whole scale into their own law. So things such as idolatry, worshipping an idol, is a capital crime. Sodomy is a capital crime. Adultery, bestiality. And you've got to wonder, because they make all these things capital crimes, just how much sodomy and bestiality was going on. But quite a bit, apparently, because they're always passing laws about it. Where they don't go so far as executing people for crimes, so perhaps some woman has just been a gossip, and she has been, you know, telling lies about her sort of friends, or spreading rumours, or speaking badly about somebody behind their back, then she wouldn't obviously be executed. I think even Puritans might say that's going a bit too far. But they would perhaps be put in the stocks, where they could have, you know, rotten fruit thrown at them. They would perhaps be branded. Branding is a very popular punishment, whereby you get branded with a letter code, G for gossip. Sometimes you're branded on your hand, sometimes you're branded on your forehead. Standing at the pillory, which is a bit like standing in the stocks, where you're tied to a post. Suppose you put in a cage, or being forced to wear a sign. They like this idea of ritual humiliation. You know, it's a shame it's gone out of fashion, isn't it? Ritual humiliation. It's very effective. I remember when I was at school, all those years ago, some child accused of stealing, some other child's rubber or something. And having him out in front of the class, and like that sort of ritual humiliation of the whole class seeing this child, being accused of this crime. But they don't let teachers do that anymore, which is such a shame. Here are some examples of actual court cases that appear in New England court records. Elizabeth James and his wife accused of a matter of uncleanness. Not specified, but could easily be something like oral sex, or just having sex in an unusual position. Puritans are fine about people having sex within marriage, as long as it's the missionary position. They don't want any experimentation going on. They don't want anyone really to have pleasure from it. Man, you find for drunkenness, have to sit in the stocks for 2 days. That's a long time to sit in the stocks. It's not just an hour, it's 2 days. That will learn him. And then Dorothy, because she's not being the good wife that she should be, because she's laying hands upon her husband, to the danger of his life. Well, how much of a wuss was he? And that they worried about future evil that's going to be committed by her. That she's bound or chained to some post until she changes her behaviour and repents. The only thing she's allowed to do is to come to church. But that's a bit of an open-ended sentence. You're going to be chained to this post until you say you're sorry. And really mean it. And we have to believe you mean it. And that's basically for being a woman who is stepping outside of her gender role, which should be the one who's submissive. Remember, it's in places like Massachusetts where a man is allowed to beat his wife with a stick so long as the stick isn't thicker than his thumb. Hence the phrase, the rule of thumb. That's perfectly legal in most societies. So, you know, somebody who contravenes that kind of moral order clearly needs to be punished. You know, and you read these court records, and you can find hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of examples like this. This is only a few that I've picked out for you. And we still have pillories standing around. This one has a slow man in it. Some students, I think, did that. But they still exist, you know, these sorts of places where people can be punished. So do they manage to create their religious utopia? Well, there are some things that even they can't control. They may be able to control what a man and a woman do in the privacy of their own bedroom, or at least they may try to. But there are other things they can't control. Geographic mobility is one. The whole township policy, the idea of granting lands to groups of families to give out in townships, means that people do spread out probably more quickly than they want. And they can't really effectively, in Boston, control what's going on 100 miles away or 200 miles away west. And of course, the further away you get from Boston, the less able you are to, you know, interact economically with the capital, the more time you're forced to spend effectively surviving. And of course, that is to the detriment of religion most of the time. You have to spend more time on basic economic needs. But also, interestingly enough, the Puritans can't prevent religious dissent in their own communities. And people like Anabaptists, and especially Quakers, get persecuted by Massachusetts authorities. And it is very slightly ironic, do you not think, that all those people who leave England because of persecution end up going to America persecuting other people. And they rationalise this by saying, you know, we've left England to create a religious utopia. How can we create a religious utopia when we can't agree on what religion we all agree on? And so you persecute people in order to create a religious utopia. It is quite an interesting bit of sort of double thing going on. But it's just, and it's this religious challenge that is one of the biggest challenges. Another challenge that they face is the fact that the numbers of full church members, the numbers of visible saints as a proportion of society is falling. And remember, these people are the people who can vote and serve in the assembly. So the number of people who are participating in the government of Massachusetts is falling. And having a franchise that's based on church membership isn't a problem when most people are church members. It does become a problem when the number of church members is falling. And it becomes less and less democratic. Why does church membership fall? Well, there are people who were moving to Massachusetts, migrating to Massachusetts, especially in the 1640s and 50s, who aren't Puritans. And this is an issue. Secondly, the children, and especially the grandchildren of original migrants, aren't so worried about religion. The children could be baptised into becoming a full church member because of their parents, but the grandchildren couldn't. And the children, you know, possibly there's a bit of generation, you know, rebelling going on here, but also, unlike people who left England, who left persecution in England, and who really valued their religious freedoms, the children had never had their religion under threat. They didn't take it quite so seriously. You know, it's like, well, who's going to come and stop us being Puritans? You know, why do I have to go through all this, you know, rigmarole? And there's also at least the suggestion that the conversion experiences, which had to be sort of accepted by other visible saints, that barrier, that hurdle became a little bit harder. You know, there's the classic generational conflict. You know, older people saying, oh, well, in my day, you know, it was all related to this to get, you know, conversion experience. And it's like me saying, like, all A-levels, when I did A-levels, calling them really hard. When you did A-levels, calling them really easy. That's why I didn't get 15 A's at A-level. And that's that classical looking back and, you know, thinking that the younger generation has it easy, and therefore you want to make it harder for them. And you set the barrier that would be a bit higher. So the sort of solution that they come up with, that they concoct, is the halfway covenant of 1662, whereby you are permitted to baptise grandchildren of visible saints, but a lot of people don't think that's an acceptable solution. And it doesn't suddenly reverse this drift away from religion from Massachusetts, in Massachusetts, by these younger people. And this is something that's going to come back to haunt them, I think, as the next 20 or 30 years goes on, as Massachusetts becomes less and less democratic, and more governed by a small group of visible saints. An interesting challenge is posed by a man called Thomas Morton at a place called Merrimount. Morton arrives in the Plymouth Colony. This is before the foundation of Massachusetts in the 1630s. He arrives in New England in 1624. He doesn't like this sort of strict religious way of living pilgrims at Plymouth have established, and he creates his own community that is not based on religious doctrine or religious laws or highly moral ways of living. And he does things like promote drinking. He gets on well with the Indians. He thinks we should trade with the Indians, and he should even intermarry with them. He builds himself a maypole and has dances and celebrations around his maypole, and effectively he's sticking two fingers up at the religious authorities of Plymouth, which they obviously aren't very happy about. And he's arrested, and then because he hasn't really committed any crimes, he just doesn't follow their moral code, he's deported by the Plymouth authorities. But he returns about 10 years later, and he's arrested again, and this time they send him off to Maine to live on an island, where he eventually dies in 1643. And here's a man who has an alternative vision of what life in New England might be like, and it's just not tolerated by authorities there. This is the maypole being chopped down, and this is Thomas Morton's own writings about Merrimount, and he writes this book called New England Canaan, and I think the maypole is the ultimate snub. It's the ultimate example of slightly pagan, slightly bacchanalian, I guess, a symbol of people having way too much fun, and that's just simply not permitted. They call the maypole an idol, the calf of Horeb. And they don't call it Merrimount, they call it Mount Dagon. It's like this mountain of sin and the devil. And they're going to make it a woeful mountain, not a Merrimount. But yes, you can imagine he's got it's sort of like a frat party going on. And people in Plymouth aren't particularly appreciative of the fact that people are having way too much fun at Merrimount. And that's something that can't be tolerated. Another, but very different type of dissenter is Roger Williams. He arrived very early on in Boston, soon after the foundation of Boston in 1631. He served for a while as the minister of Salem, famous, of course, 6 years later, which is just north of Boston. And for a while he gets on fine, he's well respected. But he goes against official doctrine. Remember, Puritans don't agree with a split within the Church of England there. You want to reform it from within. And Williams says, no, actually, it's too late. The Church of England's too corrupt, and it's beyond redemption. We need to have a new start. We need to have our own religion here. But probably more significantly, he also says that he didn't think the King's Charter for New England was worth the paper it was written on, because the land belongs to the Indians and not to the King. And so how could the King grant lands in America? It's not his. And of course, this is real, a problematic statement to make, undermine the whole fabric of government. And so Williams is banished, but he just migrates south and he founds a new colony near Ireland in 1635. And he gets on very well with the local Indian chief, a man called Miantanomi, who's the Narragansett chief. And I've mentioned him before when I talked about the Narragansetts. So it's a different type of dissenter, a religious dissenter, effectively. And again, banished. There is Roger Williams talking to the Narragansett. Anne Hutchinson, another very, very interesting figure. An arrival in Massachusetts during the Great Migration in 1634. She again is a religious dissenting. She doesn't believe in church hierarchies. She doesn't believe in ministers. She believes in what she calls the doctrine of inner light. She talks about individuals learning about God from God, and that they don't need somebody in between to interpret for them. They don't need sermons. They don't need ministers. It's a popular doctrine. It's something that becomes very popular amongst Quakers. The problem is, partly this is heresy, because it does away with the whole idea of like a structured church, church government. But more significantly, it's a problem because Anne Hutchinson is obviously a woman, and this is way beyond what a woman should be doing. She should not be talking about religion, she should not be talking about public policy, she should not be really doing anything outside of her domestic duties. And so because she challenges traditional Puritan orthodoxy and hierarchy, she has to be dealt with. They even at one point summon her husband and tell him that he has to go and control his wife. Clearly he's not been good at doing that. She has a trial and she's banished, like Williams. She's banished from Massachusetts in 1637, and she goes and follows Williams to Rhode Island. But she's murdered by Indians in 1643, and there is at least some suggestion that the Indians were put up to that by the government of Massachusetts. They basically took out a hit on her and had her dealt with. Not conclusive evidence, but there's at least some suggestion that there was foul play in the foul play. There's a rather dowdy picture of Anne Hutchinson during her trial. The Quakers, the three other people, Thomas Morton, Roger Williams, Anne Hutchinson, they're individuals. They maybe have one or two followers, but they're not really significant threats. They're significant threats in the sense that they undermine the unity, but they are not a movement. The Quakers are a movement, and the Quakers numerically certainly pose the biggest threat to this holy experiment in New England. Major Quaker beliefs are pacifism, you can't use weaponry, and like Anne Hutchinson, they believe in this doctrine of inner light. They don't believe in priests, hierarchies, they don't believe in churches, organised religion. They don't even believe in social hierarchy. They believe in complete equality amongst mankind. It's a very sort of communistic type take on society. The only authority, of course the exception of communists don't believe in God either, but Quakers believe in God, and it's only God that matters. Kings, princes, lords, ladies, bishops, archbishops, who cares about what they think? The only thing that's important is God and his relationship with you as an individual. And of course, this is heresy on so many different levels and in so many different religions. It's heresy for Protestants, it's heresy for Catholics, and Quakers are persecuted by absolutely everybody because of their beliefs. The fact that they won't resist with violence even adds to that persecution, because there's no kind of anybody defending Quakers, they're just persecuted. The problem with Quakers is that they're not content to be like a secret society, or not content to just have private views. What they like to do is shout about their views, and they want to go and convert people to their way of life. And they do so by interrupting sermons, which of course, remember, that's the central part of what the New England Sunday service is going to be about, the sermon. And Quakers will barge in and shout down the priest and say, no, this is how it should be. Understandably, Puritans are a little bit miffed by that sort of thing. The Puritan government in Massachusetts talks about them being a cursed sect, and they ratchet up the punishments for Quakers. For example, if you were even caught talking to a Quaker, you could be fined. If you actually were a Quaker and you were convicted of being a Quaker, you'd be whipped, you could be mutilated, they take off an ear, take off another ear. You'd be banished. The problem with Quakers is that they're like bad pennies. They just turn up. They keep on coming back. They don't accept banishment as a punishment. Even if, if you come back, I will execute you, they don't care. And in a way, Quakers see that as just another test of their faith, in that they are showing evidence of just how faithful and how religious they are by their steadfastness to their faith. And so finally, when four Quakers do return from banishment, the Massachusetts government is sort of put into a corner, and they end up being executed. And the persecution of Quakers only stops after the restoration of Charles II, when he instructs the government of Massachusetts to stop executing Quakers. But even the ending of executions does not end persecution and discrimination against Quakers. So the Quakers are something that constantly undermine and snipe away, are a constant thorn in the side of the government of Massachusetts. And here, you know, is a book printed in London telling all about the sort of evil treatment that Quakers have received in New England. About some who have been executed, some have been beaten. The Quakers like to meet together like this, the Society of Friends, and they meet and discuss issues. It's always, you know, first and equals, you know, they wouldn't have hierarchies in the way that others would. So, New England sort of is moving from being a very, you know, organised, structured, everyone in families, everyone in township society in the 1620s and 30s, to being a bit less stable than that. There are all these challenges that they can't stop. You know, the fact that immigration is ongoing, the fact that the economy is developing, the fact that the oldest settlers, of course, are dying off, the younger settlers don't have the same religious zeal, these are a problem. You've got internal issues with the Quakers, you've still got external threats, for example, from the French in Canada, from Indian tribes. So New England is becoming more diverse, just as the Chesapeake is becoming more stable. But they're still really quite different societies. They've moved like from the extremities of a sort of continuity of stability to being a bit closer together, but there's still a great big gap in between them. So they still are quite different in 1660. And that's the main message to get across from today's lecture.